Hello and welcome back to the Mobile Chicanes for another week. I'm Naveen Razik. Alongside me, as always, it's Joshy Carroll. We'll be talking everything happening in a big, big weekend, probably the biggest weekend all year of motorsports, including the Indianapolis 500. But first, we're going to talk Formula One and the upcoming Monaco Grand Prix. And we'll get through some news first. In particular, this really interesting story that came out that Pastor Maldonado says he turned down the opportunity to return to Formula One. So he was actually offered a seat, but he said it wasn't competitive. So we don't know exactly who was offering it to him. He still has a sponsorship from the oil company of Venezuela, around $46 million per year. But yeah, the question is, who on earth would offer it to him? And why on earth would he turn it down? I guess there's probably only a couple of things we can really put into this, Josh.
Yeah, like, I mean, I would have to say that that leading candidate would be Sauber, of course. Obviously, you know, if they did replace Marcus Ericsson with Maldonado, you know, would inject some more funds into the team. And realistically, you know, I don't think anyone is really sure about where Marcus Ericsson and Pastor Maldonado actually sit in terms of who's the better driver. So, you know, it could be, you know, the most likely case. And then there are a few more teams up and down the paddock. But Sauber would be probably the leading candidate, as ever since Manor collapsed at the start of this year, you know, it's gotten, you know, much tougher for actual pay drivers to get in, because, you know, at the moment in F1, there's so many established teams and so many manufacturer teams that the actual small, struggling for fun teams is, you know, vastly reduced. And even Sauber have been owned for getting close to 12 months now by Swiss investors. So yeah, it's just the state of play right now. And, you know, he has said that, you know, he hasn't ruled out a seat, going for a seat next year and going back into F1 next year. However, you know, it's very, very difficult for any driver, whether you're world champion or Maldonado, to just come back, into the sport after a couple of years of not really racing anything. So, and especially as well with these new, more physically demanding 20 new generation F1 cars. So yeah, it's a very, very unlikely that he, you know, actually be physically fit enough to come back and to race F1 again. Because how old is he? He's getting into his mid to late 30s, isn't he?
Yeah, he certainly would be old, because he's been on the circuit since around 2011. Yeah, but it's interesting you say that, in that it's so difficult for pay drivers to come. We've seen what's happened with Lance Stroll. He's 32, so he hasn't got much left in him. And you have to say that the only benefit he would really bring would have to be financial. He has, of course, won a Grand Prix and all of that, so you can't really take that away from him. But it's been 5 years, and he hasn't really shown much signs of improvement in the rest of the time he's been in Formula One. And the fact that he hasn't found his way somewhere else, including the World Endurance Championship or the Indy 500, as was touted earlier this year, I think shows exactly what's happened to poor Maldonado's career. But don't worry, his cousin is Manuel Maldonado, I believe his name is already racing around and already causing some incidents in British Formula 4, so we might not have to wait long for another Maldonado to make their way onto the world stage. Moving on to some of the other news, Haas have revised their livery for this year, of course. Fantastic to talk about liveries on a podcast, you can't actually see them. But they've basically included more grey, gotten rid of a lot of the red they had on the car, that it's really gone, yeah, the gunmetal grey look, which you weren't a fan of, Josh. You thought it was really, really, really dull.
No, I'm not a fan of this at all. Realistically, they've taken away all the red, and the only thing that's left is the small Haas, that's red, is the small Haas logo, just in front of the shark fin, and, you know, one very small, red stripe on either side, you know, just in front of the rear axle. So, yeah, not a fan of it at all, and, you know, just right now, like, it was raised, you know, a few days ago, about, Kurt Busch's, full on Haas livery that he ran last year. And that was, well, the bonnet at least was full on red. And it looked, fantastic. And you really do have to say, have to say, you know, yeah, there it is, red and black, with Monster backing on the side. You do have to say, you know, in this new era where, you know, media and, where the media and sponsorship is so important, you know, you just wonder why F1 teams don't go, and, have more, you know, vibrant, more attractive and more appealing, liveries, you know, that would really benefit the sponsors and would also look amazing. Because, like, in NASCAR for a long, long time now, I'd have to say 10 years now, they've had a variety of different colors, for their liveries. They've had, green, they've had yellow, they've had, you know, the full on Monster black, for a few years. They've had blue, they've had, you know, Jeff Gordon's, legendary red and blue flames. You know, you just wonder, you know, with, you know, with how big, you know, an F1 factory is, and how big their marketing departments all are, you just wonder how, you know, the smaller, well, apart from, like, say, the big boys of Hendrick Motorsports and Joe Gibbs Racing, you just wonder how the little, you know, teams in America go NASCAR racing, do it so much better than the big F1 teams. You know, like, yes, this year has been a big improvement. This year has been, quite an improvement with the, McLaren Orange. But even then, the IndyCar, McLaren Orange is just, it just looks so much better. And, you know, when they did the copy and paste renderings, of the, McLaren IndyCar, onto this year's actual F1 car, it just looks so much better. Like, I just don't understand why teams, F1 teams are afraid to go, you know, full orange and just put stickers, or full on green with stickers. You know, it, you know, just not those colors, not full on gray and stickers, but full on, you know, full on like purple, full on violet, full on baby blue and stickers. You know, it just, yeah, it's just something that I just don't understand.
It's an interesting point you raise. And of course, F1 has been slowly getting better. It's we're a far cry today from 50 Shades of Grey, which is what we were a couple of years ago. But it does raise the interesting point, particularly now that they're pushing for more driver identification, including the bigger numbers and things. Of course, India has actually docked, I think, $32,000 for not putting a, or something like that, for not putting their numbers on the thing. And you see from the way the cars have tried to interpret these rules, they're all different. And it sort of wonders, should F1 possibly go down the split livery route? Because at the moment, the regulations prevent that. If you're a team, you have to have the same colours on each car, pretty much. I think the only change you can have is some slight adjustments in terms of the names and things like that. But it's pretty much locked on. You actually have to get special dispensation from the FIA to change that. Should F1 go down sort of the slightly different livery for each driver kind of route? Because I think that could really be, it's probably an easier way to identify it. For example, if the Ferraris is an obvious one, if we change the white on Kimi Raikkonen's car to black, that's already distinctive. It's still a Ferrari car, but it's distinctively different. And I think that's really something that F1 needs to look at, is exactly how supercars or NASCAR do it, where they, or IndyCar even, which is probably the best example, because they have a same, for Penske, they have pretty much the same design on each car, but the colours mean it's different. You can easily pick your favourite driver from a mile away. Will Power's always in the grey. Simon Pagenaud is usually in something bright yellow. Something similar for Helio Castroneves. And Newgarden is one of the darker cars. So I think maybe Formula 1 needs to have a look at possibly the small but distinct adjustments they need to make deliveries to make it better. And I think if we roll that out across merchandise and things, it's a way for fans to really, I guess, really represent their driver and stuff. So I think it's probably something that F1 needs to have a good look at.
Yeah, and I really do think it is time, you know, just to bring, you know, to get rid of that rule, because, you know, every other racing category in the world, whether it's MotoGP, supercars, NASCAR, IndyCar, IMSA, you know, World Endurance Championship, you know, they all do it. So it really just doesn't, you know, make, you know, a lot of sense, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Liberty Media do talk about it at some point later this year, just to improve the show. As, yeah, it's just something to get with the times, because let's not forget, these days, you know, sponsors don't actually sponsor the team really anymore. They more or less sponsor the drivers themselves. So, you know, Pastor Maldonado, you know, he's got his, you know, big Venezuelan oil company behind him. And certainly, you know, it looks a little bit weird when, you know, it's just weird when, you know, Maldonado was, you know, was basically at Lotus, and, you know, on the other, and on the other car, you know, it still has his backing, you know, even though, the sponsor and the second driver have nothing to do with each other. So, yeah, and you know, it just would, you know, it would just make, you know, it's so much easier, you know, legally, you know, just with sponsorships and terms and conditions and just all the nitty gritty, you know, all the nitty gritty minor details that, you know, really does, you know, quite a few times just, it just holds F1 back commercially. And, yeah, it's just, it really is definitely, you know, a big room for improvement. You know, yes, there will be, you know, some slight resistance against it, but realistically, you know, it's not going to change anything about F1's past. You know, drivers are still going to be recognizable, and, you know, if it works for every other category in the world, then why shouldn't it work for Formula One?
Exactly, and I mean, the last time Formula team tried this was, of course, BAR Honda. Actually, no, they weren't Honda at that point. I think they were Supertech or something obscure. British American Racing, of course, was sponsored by British American Tobacco, and they had both the 555 and Lucky Strike brands. I probably wouldn't be allowed to say that on commercial radio. But they had two distinct cigarette sponsors, and they tried to run them on different cars. It didn't work, and ended up having a split livery, quite literally a split livery on both cars, where heart one side was blue and one side was white. It was a real odd one, but even if you look at something smaller, distinct, like Penske's efforts in supercars last year, it just shows what you can do when it sort of the missed potential in terms of sponsorship, but just in terms of it's much easier for a company to sponsor one car than both, and that just is a way that teams can bring in some extra money from companies, smaller companies, I guess, who don't have the money to sponsor two cars, but will be happy to sponsor one. So moving on to some of the smaller F1 news, news that not surprises us at all, that Pirelli are going to try and soften up the F1 tyre compounds for next year. Of course, this year's tyres have been very, very, very hard indeed. So much so that the hard tyre was pretty much abandoned over the Spanish Grand Prix, and it's actually been pulled from the British Grand Prix tyre allocation. So they're not going to bother running it. It's just too hard, and it just takes too much effort to warm it up. So it's a real bizarre tyre. So I think it shows, perhaps, whilst the tyres have been generally pretty good, it might have been better for them to make them a little bit softer, whilst making sure that the construction of the compounds is the same as this year, because this year's tyres have been, I guess, much better in terms of the way they've held out and the degradation and the likes, but they've still been a little bit too hard and a bit too difficult, I guess, for teams to manage, and we have had some rather dull one-stop races.
Yeah, absolutely, and I wouldn't really be surprised if the hard tyre completes less than 100 running laps this year, with it being avoided, you know, almost entirely at the Spanish Grand Prix, it being scrapped from the British Grand Prix in favour of the super soft tyre, and right now Japan is the only sort of it's the only possible track that the hard tyre could be run at. But even then, last year was mainly softs and mediums, even last year. So it's even going to be more the same this year. So, yeah, it's just a logical decision, and you know, it is something that was really enjoyable to watch last year. The more softer compounded tyres, and you know, yes, there are fans that do complain about, you know, how just how short the lifespan is of a super soft tyre last year around China. But realistically, you know, it really was really good for the strategy. And, you know, tyres are the only thing that F1 has in terms of actual pit strategy themselves. As if it wasn't for the tyres, then it would basically, you know, basically make pit stops, you know, meaningless. And, you know, it would all, you know, strategy would all come down to ERS management and being in a certain gap between the car and deliberately letting them through to basically have the DRS on the next straight. So, yeah, it is something they need to do because realistically it makes up a lot of F1 strategy in the current era. And, yeah, it's just no one really enjoys a one-stop race from, like, what will probably be at this weekend at Monaco, ultra-softs to super-softs.
Yeah, nobody does really enjoy that, and it's just probably one of the things that sort of pulls back Formula One in a way like that. So, moving on, let's talk about the Grand Prix of Monaco. Probably one of the most unique circuits on the calendar, just 19 beautiful turns, or mostly beautiful turns, depends on your opinions of some of the chicanes, a 40-meter elevation drop, which is pretty much unheard of on street circuits. Always difficult for overtaking, it always puts on a spectacle. Not necessarily an entertaining spectacle, but it's still basically something nice if you've got a high-definition television to watch on a Sunday night. There's a lot of questions being raised this week, and particularly about this wheelbase that the Mercedes has, which is actually, if you put the maths, are almost 20 centimeters longer than the Ferrari, almost 20 centimeters longer than the Williams. It's not much. The question is whether that will possibly pull Mercedes up when it comes to the race. Of course, there is a case for going longer with aerodynamics, but you don't want to make it too long because then you struggled to get around. Josh, do you think it really will make much of a difference in Monaco? Is it just people hoping that the Mercedes isn't as dominant as it usually is?
Well, it's really difficult to say right now. Like, I don't think we'll really know until qualifying on Saturday night. So, and even then, you know, that's when the Monaco Grand Prix finishing order is decided. So, it's really difficult to tell. Like, it might, you know, really hinder Mercedes, but, you know, you just don't know. You know, and even if Ferrari, you know, do get Raikkonen and Vettel 1 and 2 throughout the practice sessions on Thursday and on to Saturday, then the talk about them breaking their long Monaco Grand Prix drought, where Ferrari haven't won there since the early 2000s, back in the Michael Schumacher era for Ferrari, that will come up, and that will put big pressure on Ferrari to just deliver and to break that long, cruel drought that they're in right now for Monaco. So, yeah, you know, one thing could lead to another. So, you know, this could really be a weekend that has a full-on domino effect. It's going to be, you know, a really, you know, high pressure weekend, and, you know, it's just going to be a weekend where mind games will be, you know, will just be, you know, a prominent feature, more so than the previous five races so far. So Monaco this weekend could be pretty interesting. Like, It's almost certainly going to be a Mercedes or Ferrari victory, because Red Bull right now just, you know, basically nowhere, stuck in fifth and sixth, heading nowhere. Force India could, you know, surprise for a top five, as they're in good form right now, and everyone else is going to be fighting very, very hard for the rest of the midfield positions and the rest of the points, including Jenson Button, who seems to be, you know, in a good place for his this will almost definitely be his last ever race in F1, as he has said earlier this week that he has no interest whatsoever coming back into F1 full time in 2018. So this will most likely be his final Grand Prix, which will be a shame, but it will be, you know, something to, hopefully gets, you know, something along the lines of what Massa got, back in Brazil. As it's unfortunate that, you know, he didn't really have, it wasn't announced, the last time he did the British Grand Prix. So, yeah, a bit sad that this will be Jensen's, last ever Grand Prix, but, you know, he seems to be, you know, in a good headspace. You know, he's not, daddy himself. He's not, being overwhelmed by the challenge. And he seems to be looking forward to it for his final ever Grand Prix. There's a lot going on in the paddock this weekend, and after the Indy 500 Monaco Grand Prix craziness has all settled down, and Alonso is back in Europe and getting ready for the rest of the European season, then the silly season will really kick off, and the centre of the silly season this year will most likely be Kimi Raikkonen, Valtteri Bottas, and Fernando Alonso. So they'll be the big three players to keep your eye on over the next couple of months. Realistically, all the basically craziness of what is to come will start at Monaco this weekend.
Indeed, and most importantly, we could see a change in the leader of the Drivers' Championship. Sebastian Vettel has led it at every race so far this year. This could be the opportunity where Lewis Hamilton takes the lead, and that will be a very closely fought battle indeed. Let's head back to Australia and the Supercars Championship, which was in action over the weekend at Winton in Victoria. And it was a very interesting weekend. It was pretty much a tale of two races. The first race was much like the races we saw preceding it, a very dominant, very comfortable performance from DJR Team Penske and Scott McLaughlin in particular, who took his third race win in a row. But then race two completely changed. It was like we flashed back a couple of months to the start of the season. Shane Van Gisbergen took the win. He led JV Whitcup, who led most of the race. Whitcup ending up with 2 second places, which I don't think was the result he was hoping for. But it was a real dominant performance from Triple H, who've been struggling a little bit all year with trying to get that pace and trying to get that car onto the top step of the podium after their strong performance at Clipsal. It was just a real overnight change, which was quite extraordinary. And I guess it sort of opens up the championship and makes things even more interesting than they already are, considering how close the championship now is. The top four drivers within 40 points, which is exceptional at this stage of the year.
Yeah, for sure. It was a really hard-fought Sunday race. Almost textbook in terms of what Winton can provide. Really bad weekend for Chas Mostert, retiring because of a control component failure in race 9, and then just being considerably just not up there in race 10, finishing all the way but basically down in 8th place, which is just not what he would have wanted to consolidate, just to recover from race 9, as I did say it was a big weekend for Chas Mostert, and that was crucial to his championship chances, and now he finds himself almost 200 points behind Fabian Coulthard. So it just shows how tight this championship fight is, and also as well, because it's only 26 races and because there are only 16 races left this year, it just shows how critical each and every race will be for the rest of the season. It's only 4 points between Fabian Coulthard and Jamie Whincup at the top of the standings, with Scott McLaughlin and Shane Van Gisbergen close behind. And Jamie Whincup has also said earlier this week that he's really just itching and just almost getting desperate to win a race this year, as it's pretty remarkable. We're 10 races in and Jamie Whincup is yet to score a race victory, it's got to come soon, looking ahead, to Darwin, Tansball and Ipswich. Darwin, he's had quite a few good performances. He's never really I don't think he's ever really finished outside the top 10 at Darwin for a race that hasn't been in his control. Like, he might have had component failure or two. Tansville, he's been really good in the past. And Ipswich, it's a bit, he does okay there. So I'd be really, really surprised, Naveen, if he hasn't won a race by Ipswich, and that will really be crunch time for him, because after Ipswich it is Sydney Motorsport Park and then the Enduro. So Yeah, could we see, could we possibly see Jamie Winkup's first season in a very, very long time where he doesn't win a race? Like, I know there's 16 races to go and it's still pretty early in the season, but if he doesn't win a race at, in the next three rounds, you just have to ask yourself if he's, basically going to possibly win a championship without winning a race this year.
Or possibly if he's going to win a championship for a while, because this is, of course, been 2 years since the most successful man in supercars has won a driver's championship. Well, three years technically, something like that. Looking down the order, another disappointing weekend for HSV without their manager Adrian Burgess. They're currently having a worldwide search. They struggled to crack the top 15. I think they only got one top 15 finish. That being Scott Pye, just managed to get that Commodore in there, and other than that, pretty disappointing weekend. Courtney got dumped out late during the race, and yeah, not exactly the way they wanted to go. Probably the star performer of the weekend, Cameron Waters, race 2, fourth position, the highest place of the Pro Drive runners. He's really saved on the radar last year, but this year he does look like he's got it together. He's much stronger, and I think in general he's probably been one of the better performers. I think he's probably been one of the best performers, I guess, of Pro Drive so far this year. Aside from, of course, Molster, who's been up there. But he could really start to challenge for a podium now. And I think that's exciting that for Pro Drive that they finally got somebody in that second Ron Nash garage who could support Chaz Molster and possibly help them put in a good effort in the team championship.
Yeah, for sure. And he actually did say to Greg Murphy after race 10 on Sunday night, that that he believes he can get a podium, and that's his next goal. So Cam Waters, the only way for him is up. Like I've been keeping a close eye on him ever since his debut with Grant Denyer at the 2011 Bathurst 1000, beating Paul Dumbrell as the basically the youngest ever Bathurst 1000 starter, and he really has come into his own, and he is actually showing up Mark Winterbottom so far this year, which is no small feat by any means. So yeah, a fantastic weekend for him. Another fantastic weekend for Dave Reynolds as well, getting more top tens for Erebus Motorsport, which is fantastic considering where they were about 14 to 16 months ago. And also as well, Garth Tander and James Moffat actually both getting very good and very respectable places at Winton last weekend. As James Moffat, I think James Moffat is really enjoying himself this year. He's enjoying being back in a VF Commodore. He's enjoying having Garth as a teammate. And yeah, you do have to basically sit back and realize how much the team was based around Scott McLaughlin when back in the Volvo days for GRM. He's really comfortable right now. Like, he's getting top tens, and he's actually been competitive and not being way back in 24th place. So I think Moffat is really enjoying himself, and he's really cemented his place on the supercars grid. As he's always been a bit of a floater. And he's always been here or thereabouts, and now that he's finally getting these good results, I think he's really firmed up as to basically be once Garth retires, the team leader for GRM over the next few years when James Colding comes through and needs him, and it's most likely that Moffat will mentor him and teach him the ropes as he and Garth did at Winton last weekend. So yeah, very good signs for James Moffat, I can see it probably continuing. And
speaking of Garth Tander, he's now a few points behind Chaz Mostert. He's sixth place. That really has been the best silly season move in the last few years for supercars. He's gone from a team which has just gone downhill to Gary Rogers, who's just, and this is a phenomenal effort on Rogers' behalf, to be able to get some last-minute Holden Commodore machinery. They were pretty much only really moving over in December, and to get them working so well in a way that Erebus haven't, in a way which I guess none of the other Holden teams have, they are now probably the second-best Holden team on the grid. It's just been a phenomenal performance from them. And I guess, yeah, it's just an enormous stroke of for James Moffat, who's been very lucky that even despite the Volvo shenanigans, he's still been able to land himself in a good team, and for Garth Tander, who when he jumped ship probably really thought he would be out of the Lurcham without a drive for this year. I guess two very lucky and very, I guess, yeah, just generally lucky decisions to go with Gary Rogers. And Gary Rogers, they've worked hard and they've managed to get that hole in working, which is a good thing to see. And it's, as a GRM fan myself, but yeah, it's just really exciting. I guess it does show that hopefully if they do get some next-gen Commodores next year, they can really start to challenge the likes of AAA possibly for race wins.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, but basically, you know, Gary Rogers, you know, all the staff that, you know, built basically four Commodores in a very, very short space of time over the Christmas break have done a fantastic job, because not only have they built them really, really, really quickly, they've built them with, you know, absolutely pristine quality and excellent reliability, which is, you know, almost impossible in this day and age. As you know, there have been a falterings for their two cars, for I think it's Dragon Motorsport in the Super 2 series. So fantastic job by them, and Gary Rogers did say that they are going to be running. If they're not going to receive next gen Commodores next year, they will be running their cars from this year. And I think, you know, part of that is I think most of that is down to, you know, he doesn't want to put his team through another very long, very demanding Christmas break. Because, you know, Gary, you know, he does care about his team, and, you know, he does, you know, and, you know, it would be easy to say that Gary Rogers Motorsport has one of the highest team morale in the paddock, you know, right up there with Brad Jones Racing. So, yeah, that's just what he's given, because, you know, it's certainly still possible to, you know, put together a Kia package, which is what they were discussing with Kia, a Kia Stinger package throughout this year. That's what they've been talking about, and it's easy to assume that those talks are still ongoing. Just signing out the Kia Stinger and those renderings look absolutely fantastic. Fingers crossed it does happen. But anyway, you know, he really does care, and, you know, it's just good times ahead for Gary Rogers, as, you know, I can assume that himself, Garth, James, Moffat and Golding, and the rest of the team will be much looking forward to their well-earned Christmas break at the end of the year.
Certainly it does sound exciting. Let's move now to the United States and to the biggest open wheel race of the year. The Indianapolis 500 qualifying took place over the week, and we'll be going through it all in detail, as well as our picks for the race later in the show. We start off though first with the somewhat sad news and the very disappointing news about what's happened to Sebastian Bourdais. After a dream start to the championship, he has had a terrible run of luck at Indianapolis. He had engine problems which took him out of the Indianapolis Grand Prix last weekend, and his problems were only compounded when he had a massive 227-mile-per-hour crash into the safety barrier at Turn 2 of Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It was a massive fiery crash. He flipped the car as well. I was watching it on the morning, and it just took everybody by surprise, and had a half an hour delay. And since then, it's been revealed that he sustained multiple fractures to his pelvis and his fractured hip, which were operated on that night. He is standing again with the aid of crutches, but he is now out for the rest of the season, and it's going to be a long road back if he actually does come back to IndyCar. I guess it's a really disappointing story, particularly for Dale Coyne, who were the real surprise and the real like Techno in Supercars, the small team that could. And it's disappointing to see the way their season has panned out, particularly with the loss of Bourdais, who is arguably still at the height of his powers.
Yeah, for sure. And Sebastian Bourdais has come out, you know, I think the last day, saying that, you know, he definitely will try to make a comeback, as, you know, he wants to keep racing, as, you know, that's just what Sebastian Bourdais does. You know, he's been racing open wheelers. Ever since the Champ Car days back in the early 2000s, and he wants to continue it. So top marks to him. In his place, Dale Coyne won't be withdrawing their entry for the Indy 500 this coming weekend, as they will be instead putting in James Davison, who is the brother of Alex and Will. A really good opportunity for him. And, it is pretty exciting for Dale Coyne Racing having, James Davison and, Ed Jones, two really young guys, desperately wanting to get, as much experience as possible. Both, sending them out for the 101st running of the Indy 500. So, as soon as I saw it, it was like, oh, yeah, James Davison, another Davison, going out for another big race. So, good luck to James Davison and, Sebastian Bourdais, very good that he's wanting to come back, especially after that 118G crash, which, will be the biggest crash of his career. 118G crash is, no small crash by any, means. And, he's pretty fortunate. And, it really does speak for the safety of IndyCar to come out with, the injuries that he does. It will take some time, but I wouldn't really be that surprised if he's, back with Dale Coyne, racing, by the time the series heads to the finale at Sonoma. Yes, it will take time, but, it certainly won't take, 6 months.
That is the big question, of course, and you have to remember that another very experienced, very talented driver, Dario Franchitti, his career came to an early end after a similarly big crash where he received neck injuries, and he's given medical advice that he wasn't able to drive an IndyCar again, which is a sad story, and hopefully that doesn't happen with Sebastian Bourdais, although that that cloud will hang over him. And of course, he'll miss out on his chance to defend his Le Mans win as well, which would be disappointing. And he could have possibly held the 24 hours of Daytona and the 24 hours of Le Mans as well if he won this year. And it's a shame that that won't be happening. He was, of course, going to drive for the Ford GT team, that Chip Ganassi Racing entry. So let's review the weekend. That was in qualifying on Sunday morning, Saturday afternoon in the United States. Only one run because of rain, which meant that we ended up with a much more interesting group heading into the Fast Nine. Leading Saturday qualifying was Ed Carpenter, who already taken two poles at the Indianapolis 500. Fernando Alonso snuck in as well. Looking at the drivers who got into the Fast Nine, it was Carpenter, Takuma Sato, Scott Dixon, J.R. Hildebrand, Alexander Rossi, Will Power, Fernando Alonso in 7, Tony Kanaan, and Marco Andretti. A real interesting spread in that top 9, I guess, of some of the drivers we don't usually see, the big heavyweights, like Ryan Hunter-Reay, Helio Castroneves, Graham Rahal, Newgarden, Montoya, Hinchcliffe, Pagano, all missing out and all sort of really far behind, which really surprised a lot of people. But I guess those changing conditions, as well as the fact that qualifying ran late and the changes in track temperature, really favoured the guys who ran later in the stint, and it really provided a very interesting Fast 9, didn't it, Josh?
Yeah, it really did, and I don't think anyone was really expecting only one Penske car in the name of Will Power getting into the Fast 9. So, people are just wondering right now, where is Penske's speed? Because people were expecting them to be fast, and let's not forget they did win the Indy 500 with Juan Pablo Montoya only back in 2015. So. I don't really think anyone has an answer of why Penske are just so far down the order, as it's certainly not what anyone would have really predicted. So, I just don't know. It's been one of the big surprises so far. As just looking through the grid now, we'll take you through the grid. Scott Dixon for Chip Ganassi, sponsored by Camping World, for the Indy 500, will line up on pole alongside Ed Carpenter and defending Indy 500 champion Alexander Rossi.
And what a blockbuster grid front row that is. Not only Scott Dixon, who was my pick for pole position, I will remind everyone, but also Ed Carpenter and Alexander Rossi, the pride of Indianapolis and the defending 500 winner, two Americans on the front row. That's just a good news story for IndyCar in general, and it just really promises a really exciting race over the weekend. So, yeah, a really interesting and a really exciting front row, isn't it, Josh?
It really is. It really is. Like, you know, you've got the, you know, the immense talent of Scott Dixon, you know, who will definitely, almost certainly now, be up there all day come Sunday. Then you've got Ed Carpenter, who no one would have said would got onto row one for the Indy 500, but he's there, and you know he's in a really good position, and you know he has been. He and J.R. Hildebrand have been pretty fast throughout all of the practice sessions so far. So you know
they've been outperforming the Penske's, which is no mean feat.
No, certainly not. So yeah, fantastic weekend for them, and Alexander Rossi as well. You know, just backing up. You know, just the I think you know Alexander Rossi. You know, and Indianapolis Motor Speedway, it's sort of becoming, you know, one of those, you know, driver-track relationships where Alexander Rossi is set to always do immensely well at at IMS. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's just becoming one of those instances where Alexander Rossi is okay at all the other tracks, but fantastic at IMS. So, yeah, that's another, another driver to keep in mind. Going for back-to-back Indy 500 wins, which is, you know, very, very difficult to do. So
India Road, and then we go to Row 2. This is another interesting one. We've got three wild cards up here. Takuma Sato, first of all. The man who's not had the greatest of records at ovals, everybody will know, but his performance has been pretty good over all weekend, very quick in qualifying, and very well not to ditch it. Then we have Fernando Alonso, the big wild card, the rookie wild card, technically. They're from Oviedo, Spain, according to the IMS PDF we're reading off. In the McLaren Honda Andretti Honda, the quadruple banger name, they're an astonishing performance from him to get into the top five at his first tilt in Indianapolis. And the fact that he actually, during his run, which I think he was fourth off the rank in the fast nine session, to get on pole, even though he slipped down the field eventually soon afterwards, there was still a very strong performance from him. And J.R. Hildebrand, the man who almost won the 500 in 2011, were it not for that final corner crash on the last lap. In sixth position, rounding out that second row, and rounding out probably the highest place, Ed Carpenter cars, who've really, really had been surprised all of us over the weekend. A very interesting, very unique row too, just those guys who were there contending, which we didn't really think would be.
Yeah, for sure, and you know it's going. I think right now it's almost impossible to know how well any three of those drivers will be. Sato, you know, he had a terrible run at Phoenix earlier this year, and you know he really shouldn't be up there, but he somehow is. And then Alonso, you know, just continuing to, you know, just astound everyone. You know, P5. Out of 33, you know, that's a fantastic performance, for him. And, you know, he's really pleased with himself and, you know, he's really enjoying it. So, happy Alonso is a fast Alonso. So, yeah, he'll be one to watch. And J.R. Hildebrand, the massive wild card, you know, could he, you know, redeem himself, 6 years down the line and take, get that elusive milk that he almost got in 2011? We just don't know. So, yeah, and to have two Ed Carpenter Racing IndyCars in the top six on the front two rows is unheard of. So, yeah, that's going to be one to watch with great interest.
And now we come to row three, and this is interesting. This is where all the experienced guys have really ended up. Tony Kanaan, Marco Andretti, and Will Power from Toowoomba. The Penske finishing last in that fast nine session, which just shows the struggles they've had in terms of setup and pace all day. But you've got Tony Kanaan, another always strong contender. How will he fare this year? And Marco Andretti, who had a very strong performance for Andretti, I guess, still only the third fastest car compared to the real surprise quick cars in Rossi and Alonso, who've really sort of upset the apple cart in Andretti Autosports. But he'll be there as well. Another very strong performance, full of guys who will certainly capitalize. If the inexperienced guy, or I wouldn't say Takuma Sato was inexperienced, but sort of the wild card guys at the front of the grid stuff up, you have some very experienced hands, including Will Power, who is still yet to get that elusive 500 win after finishing up in second place last year.
Yeah, for sure. And, Tony Kanaan as well, you just can never discount him on an IndyCar oval. Like, yes, he hasn't been, you know, as good in form as of late. also as well. You know, he hasn't been electrifying in practice, but, you know, he's just been there in the background, getting all the data he needs, getting the right setup. And, you know, he could really be a force to be reckoned with, come lap 180. Marco Andretti as well. Just good. I think it's just good for him to just be up there, with the rest of his teammates. He will certainly, look for some good tow from the likes of Rossi, Sato and Alonso, and, Will Power, just, the lead Penske, and, just the one that's probably gonna take, all the hopes for Penske, early on. So, we've spoken about Will Power before, you know, just that elusive milk, and, you know, it would be huge for Australian motorsport, if Power won this year, you know, especially when you consider that, the company that he has in terms of Dixon, Alonso, Montoya, Kanaan, Hinchcliffe, you know, Newgarden, Paginot. Like, these are certainly not, untalented drivers by any means. So it would be huge for Australian motorsport if Will Power won this year. And it certainly would be worth the wait, if he did win the 101st Indy 500.
Yeah, we certainly have plenty to look forward to in terms of Will Power. Moving now outside the fast nine to the rest of the qualifiers. They were set in the earlier session on Sunday. Row four, Ryan Hunter-Reay, of course, the 500 winner, or the championship winner from Colvisio, and the 500 winner as well, I'm fairly sure. In the DHL Honda, he's always a strong. Ed Jones, who has only just missed out on the fast nine session, that would be great. If he had gone into the fast nine for Dale Coyne Racing, still a pretty good result starting middle of row four in 11th position, the man from Dubai. And Oriol Servia, I guess the highest place of the non-really regular runners, including Fernando Alonso, I guess, in a 12th position, for Ray Hal Letterman Lanigan Racing. Interesting lineup as well. And of course, we'll go through these quickly. So we'll do row five as well. We'll talk about some of the bigger drivers through these, two rows of a two at a time. Michaela Loschen, for SMP Racing, another solid performance from him. Smith Peterson Motorsports, pumped in 13th. Graham Rahal, who will always, I guess, surprise the in the other Rahal Lennon Lanigan entry, coming in at 14th. And Max Chilton, 15th. A solid performance, for him in the, other Andretti Honda. Certainly should be, not Andretti, sorry, Chip Ganassi Honda. So overall, the guys you have to watch for there would have to be Ryan Hunter-Reay and Graham Rahal, although we could possibly see some surprise from Ed Jones, who's been very strong so far this year, Josh.
Yeah, exactly. And Ed Jones, you know, is certainly Alonso's biggest threat, in terms of, the Indy 500 Rookie of the Year. So, yeah, it's going to be Ed Jones versus Fernando Alonso for the Rookie of the Year honours, come Sunday. And, you know, it could really be 50-50 between Ed Jones and Alonso for Rookie of the Year. Ryan Hunter-Reay as well, you know, he's been pretty solid, and just, you know, his, long run, and, long stint pace at, IMS has been pretty impressive. He's been, topping quite a few, sessions, earlier in the year, earlier this week. So Ryan Hunter-Reay is certainly always, one to keep an eye on. And Graham Rahal, as always, is, really solid. I don't think he'd be really, that happy with, 14th, but, you know, he's certainly, in the mix.
Yeah, indeed. Now moving down to rows 6 and row 7, more heavy hitters in, the, midfield. Charlie Kimball lines up, the number 83 car in 16th position. Then it's James Hinchcliffe in the middle of row 6, the pride of Canada in the, other Smith Peterson Motorsport Honda. A disappointing result for him, particularly where he was last year, considering how strong the Hondas have been, for him to be so far off the pace is a real surprise. But I guess that the changing conditions and the single runs on Saturday really sort of threw a cat among the pigeons. And when Pablo Montoya, the second place to the Penske drivers, I guess. Yes, he is, in fact, the second place to the Penske drivers, which is somewhat of a surprise. But then again, he has had good form, the two-time Indianapolis 500 winner, and of course, the kart championship from years ago, and the wild card entry for Penske. He could really be surprised. He's flown a little under the radar, but whether he could possibly get into the top 10 in the top 5 is still certainly in his reach, Josh.
Yeah, it is, and he had a really impressive return at the Grand Prix of IMS a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, he's certainly got the form, but, you know, just... Yeah, he's, you know, along with his teammates, you know, he's just not had the speed, whatsoever. So, yeah, whether or not they'll be rectified, you know, will really, you know, determine Montoya's chances. Hinchcliffe as well, you know, not the best result he would have wanted. You know, he probably would have more liked to be in the fast nine. But you know, the mayor of Hinchtown, you know, he can really do well when he's in the form, and you know, he could really be a threat. You know, he's certainly got the ability to win the Indy 500. But whether or not he will on Sunday, you know, it seems, you know, a little bit unlikely when you consider his pace so far this past few weeks.
Row 7 moving down as well. Helio Castroneves, of course, the three-time 500 winner. Never won a championship, but has always been quick and always been very quick at the 500. 19th, though, it will be tough for him to get into the top 10 unless we have a very wild race, which, of course, is almost every race. Then Jay Howard in that third Smith-Peterson Motorsports entry. A wild card there. And Sage Karam, also a wild card. Indy Dryer and Rainbold Racing entry. The Chevrolet, I guess the question there will be where Helio Castroneves sees that. He's very good at flying under the radar, he is. Whether he'll be able to work his way into what's from a difficult qualifying position, though, will be the big question.
Yeah, it will. And Castroneves, you know, he's never been one to take race wins. You know, he's always, you know, in the top three or the top five. You know, that's just what Castroneves does. Yeah, it looks like more of the same. You know, I can certainly see him, you know, going up the order, but, you know, not really challenging for the race win. Just hanging back and around the top five, and just being in the tow of his Penske teammates. So, yeah, I think, you know, it'll be another race where Castroneves flies under the radar. Like, once again, you know, he's really just not been on the pace, whatsoever for Penske and, yeah, you know, just a lot of question marks over him, as I said, with Montoya. But, you know, the good news is you know, himself and Montoya are very, very close together. So they will be, they can work together and make their way through the field for the first 20 to 30 laps. So that'll be something to keep an eye on, just the general proximity of those two guys. So, yeah, just still a lot of question marks over Penske once again.
Yeah, and that seems to be, when we talk about, yeah, and that just in general seems to be the thing, particularly when we head to row 8. We've got Joseph Newgarden, Simon Pagenaud, and Carlos Munoz, of course, all three Chevrolet runners, which has just shown the struggles that Chevrolet have had over the weekend. The defending champion and the Penske's great American hero stuck on row 8, not where they wanted to have ended up. And same with Carlos Munoz, who came second last year with Andretti, but he's fallen back. Now he's stuck at AJ Foyt Racing. So, yeah, it's going to be a uphill battle, I guess, for these guys to get in contention. Certainly they'll be up there. Joseph Newgarden could be the man to lead a charge through the field. You can say anything in Indianapolis, but it's going to be an incredibly difficult fight to get back up the order.
It will be, and you know, all three of those drivers are really, really solid, and you know, can do very, very well on the ovals. So yeah, just you know, another, you know, poor you know, set of pace from the last two Penske cars. As you know, that they'll certainly be, you know, going through all, you know, their setup and just try and change anything they could. Carb day, as you know, carb day will be very crucial for them later in the week. Carlos Munoz as well, you know, just we haven't really seen, you know, anything of him or his teammates throughout the past week, as you know, he's just been, you know, lingering, you know, in the background. So yeah, all three of those drivers certainly do have the ability to charge through the field in the first 50 laps, but you know, it's that they've really got some really tough work for them.
Yeah, and I think most of their, they'll be pushing for the improvements through the practice, which of course continues throughout this week, heading of course to carb day and to the race. Running through the last three rows quickly, 25 to 33, inside row 9, Gabby Chavez, center row 9, Connor Daly, the lowest place of the regular runners, not the result he was looking for, and he's had a very difficult start to his tenure at AJ Foyt. I don't really think he might be hanging around there for much longer. Jack Harvey, meanwhile, the lowest place, Andretti car in 27th place, so he's a rookie, so Not surprised. And finally, the last two rows are made up pretty much entirely of Wiles Kelton, who's been pretty consistently hanging around Indianapolis. Pippen Mann, Spencer Pickett, and Buddy Lazier, who was one in 1996 during the IRL days, making up row 10 and row 11. Sebastian Saavedra Zakovic, the lowest placed rookie. He will, with Foyt, of course, and James Davison, who makes not his first IndyCar start. I think he's done some other. He's had a 500 start, I think, a couple of years ago, and he's done some work. He's been very versatile. He has. He's been doing all sorts of things, but he will start right at the back with Dale Coyne Racing, and they'll be looking to find their mojo. Not really much to say about those guys. So we'll take you, Josh, to our predictions for the race. It's going to be a very, very, very interesting one indeed. And it's a very difficult one to pick. Josh, who would you say would be the most likely to take out, to drink the milk this weekend?
Well, I'm going to have to stick with my man Scott Dixon. You know, just because, you know, his form has been amazing, you know, and he just looks, you know, very, very comfortable right now in that Chip Ganassi Honda. And my smoky, I would have to say Tony Kanaan. I really do, you know, rate his chances pretty highly. And, you know, he's certainly definitely one to watch. And he certainly will be, there in the top five with, 10 laps to go. So Scott Dixon as my race winner and, Tony Kanaan as my smoky.
It's interesting, yeah. Just purely on, yeah, pure performance and form in the past, I can't really go past Scott Dixon for the win. My smokies, though, it's really, really difficult to pick. I would have to say Ed Carpenter could be flying under the radar. He's had pole twice before. This could be the year, particularly even the run he's coming to it, that he is up there. And he might have J.R. Hildebrand close behind him. And I'm also going to go with the bold prediction that Fernando Alonso will finish in the top five. Which, of course, is a very bold prediction because anything can happen. What I've seen so far in practice, he looks like he's getting very used to traffic and passing and the like. He's pulled off some decent moves. And he is probably, if anything, the only issue will be stamina. Now we can keep with it, but hopefully now he just has to focus on the race, doesn't have to focus out reliability and the other dozens of things. He has to focus on driving the Formula One car. He can really nail in and get into the zone, and I think he will be certainly up there, but of course anything can happen, and it certainly will, Josh.
Yeah, it certainly will, as you know. It's going to be a very interesting Indy 500. You know, very, very unpredictable, and there's not really much else to say, really. You know, it's basically, it'll be driver start your engines, and once the green flag flies and the pylon lights up in green, you know, all bets are off, really. Any one of those 33 drivers could taste the milk at the end of lap 200. So yeah, it's going to be really unpredictable. You know, really hoping for a willpower Indy 500 win, but I just feel like Scott Dixon has got the measure of the field.
Yeah, the numbers don't really stack up for that particular result. So that all kicks off early on Monday morning. I think it's a 3 a.m. start or something terrible like that. If you're very dedicated, you can watch both Monaco and Indy in Australia. I might possibly do that, depending, of course, on what happens with some of my other commitments. I still have, of course, a week of uni to run and all of that. Should be another great race. And another very solid Indianapolis 500, the greatest spectacle in motorsport, particularly in America, and part of a magical weekend. We will talk about something else that's happening on the weekend. We, of course, have a NASCAR race. It was, NASCAR returns to effectively its heartland in Charlotte, and pretty much the de facto home race for most of the field at Charlotte Motor Speedway. We had the curtain raiser last weekend with the All-Star race, won by Kyle Busch, finally getting his All-Star win, and it sets him up quite well for the toughest race of the year, the Coca-Cola 600. 600 miles of action last year, totally dominated by Martin Truex Jr. Could be something similar this year, Josh, indeed.
Yeah, it certainly could. And unfortunately for NASCAR, the softer tire, the green walled softer tire, didn't really pay dividends for NASCAR. You know, it was a bit of a you know, a bit of a processional race, and certainly not what any NASCAR fan would have been hoping for. But it really does, you know, set up the week for you know, the Coca-Cola 600. It certainly does show that Kyle Busch, you know, will be up there once again. And for his sake, you know, I really do hope that he you know, just gets a win and gets the monkey off the back, because if he gets second place again, you know, you just have to wonder how long will his patience last. Yeah, like, yes, he will be in the chase if he finishes second every single race, but if he finishes second every single race, you're possibly not going to win the championship. Like, it's doable to win a NASCAR Monster Energy Cup Series championship without winning a race, but, you know, it's really difficult and you don't want to leave it to chance. It's just good for him. I think it'll be good for him to just get that race win, you know, just to, like, not finish second or third once again. But, Coca-Cola 600 is where it really counts. So, 40 drivers, you know, all heading out for 600 miles, 400 long, hard-fought laps at Charlotte. And, changeable conditions, as always, you know, starting at twilight and running basically deep into the night. So, a long, long race ahead. And, JGR cars, they do look strong now. And, you can't, discount, like, the Penske cars either. So, it's another very open race. And, NASCAR really do need to perform this weekend with their Coca-Cola 600. The third part of the, glorious, weekend that is May. That is the last weekend of May with the Monaco Grand Prix and IndyCar. With everything going on, it's sort of been restricted, unfortunately, to a local, basically to what is, regarded as a local car meet, unfortunately, for NASCAR. But they just need a really good 400, lap race at Charlotte to really just, you know, get something back, from this weekend and, get, ready for the next, following, races. So, yeah, that NASCAR do need to put on a good show. If not, you know, it's really going to hurt them with how big the Monaco Grand Prix and Indy 500 both are this year.
Yeah, let's move now from four wheels to two, and some very sad news coming out of the world of MotoGP. Now, Nicky Hayden has succumbed to his injuries he got as a result of a cycling accident in Italy. He was struck by a passenger car while cycling following the last World Superbike round. He was transferred to intensive care. He hung on for some time, but he has now passed away. A very, very sad loss for the world of MotoGP, the last American Grand Prix champion from 2006. Not Grand Prix, yeah, Grand Prix world champion from 2006. He had a very, very, very solid season, and he will be missed, certainly. And it does sort of bring this very sad streak that we've had over the past few years, to where we've had so many major, I guess, fatalities in the world of motorsport, starting with Dan Weldon, moving on to Michael Schumacher, who is still fighting his injuries he picked up in early 2014, Jules Bianchi as well, Justin Wilson, and of course Luis Salom from the world of MotoGP. A very, very disappointing. It's a disappointing way to end the month of May in the world of IndyCar.
Yeah, it certainly is, and you know, it's certainly unfortunate that we have lost the man from Kentucky. As you know, he certainly did have, you know, a presence in the MotoGP field, and you know, was certainly great for MotoGP in America, where he took the fight up to Valentino Rossi and then won to take that MotoGP world crown. And it is unfortunate, as he was still racing in the World Superbike Championship earlier this year, as you know, he was putting in some okay performances, but unfortunately he won't be able to complete his second season in the World Superbike. So, as it's unfortunate, as you know, the man from Kentucky, you know, really did, you know, what really was the shining light for the up and coming American motorcycle racers. As now that the man from Kentucky has gone, you know, it really does leave a hole in the American motorcycle racing scene. As you know, it really is just Yeah, it really is just sad, how it's all occurred. But thankfully, his family was there in his last few days, which is it provides a level of comfort. And it's gonna be re really difficult for the next MotoGP race this weekend to unfortunately say goodbye from the man from Kentucky.
Yeah, it's a sad thing, and particularly because it wasn't something particularly dangerous he was doing. He was just riding his bike, and I guess it shows the importance, I guess, of just being a nice person on the road around bikes. Of course, Josh, you can probably vouch for that as you're an experienced cyclist yourself. Just the dangers that can possibly lurk, and it's just a shame that's the way he has to go. And he really shone a light for MotoGP, which is really, and I guess about bike racing in general, it really hasn't had the following in America it probably deserves. And he really was championing that series for a very sought after and a very important audience. And it's a shame that he will no longer be around to see how the series grows in America. It's a real shame. So moving on now to the action. There was some action over the weekend at Le Mans. Quite a lot of action, in particular for Jack Miller. He had a very big, a very scary shunt in free practice four just before his qualifying run, where he came off around turn 13, 14. My dog looks very interested indeed in Jack Miller's shot. I'll have to leave him out. Sorry about that. Flipped several times coming off at Le Mans. A very scary shot. He was very lucky to walk away without injuries. And apparently there was this a little feud going on in the MotoGP paddock, particularly between him and Jorge Lorenzo, about driver safety and all of that. And Lorenzo said, "Oh, that's God's way of saying, mate, you should care a bit more about safety," which seems a little bit unlucky. But he was a bit harsh on Jack Miller, but he was very lucky to escape with that. And less luck in qualifying, though. He came off and was able to qualify ninth, Josh.
Yeah, it's just a very almost man the match performance from Jack Miller to have that crash and then a few moments later get back on, straight back on the bike and qualify into Q2. Like there certainly wouldn't be many riders, especially his age, to just hop straight back on and then get into Q2. So that's good for him. And also as well, just Maverick Viñales getting his first win of the European season certainly will be good for him. And just more bad fortune for Valentino Rossi, who's done some pretty solid races over the course of this season, as it just keeps the championship open. And I'm not sure of the standings right now, but I think because of Rossi's retirement on the last lap, that Vinales would be in the lead.
Yeah, it was an interesting one. And also, we do have to talk about Johann Zarco, who's really been flying the French flag. That was a great crowd out to support him. Yeah, at the moment, Vinales has taken the lead of the championship ahead of Pedrosa and Rossi because of that incident. But yeah, Zarco, fantastic performance from him. He did finish second in the end, but he was almost on pole. He was running very close to qualifying, and he looks like he will champion the next generation of French MotoGP riders. And that is something great to see, that we've got some young talent really fighting up against the old card in terms of Marquez, Lorenzo and Rossi, who've really just dominated MotoGP for the last few years, and it's nice to see. We've got getting a bit of variety in the series at the moment. Let's move now on to some other action happening in that same time of the area of area of Europe, particularly the Paris E-Prix. It was another win for Sebastian Buemi, who's just starting to run away with it at the moment in Formula E, and a better race than Formula E than in Monaco, and of course a very disappointing race for Lucas Di Grassi, who was running, he was qualified out of the top 10, had a very disappointing race, then came together with Felix da Costa, and that pretty much put an end to any chance he had for his weekend. And he's now really starting to fall behind, I guess, Buemi, with less than half the season left to go. He's now 40 points behind, and of course Buemi will miss out on a few races because of the World Endurance Championship. I think he misses out on I think he missed out on
New York.
New York, yeah, which will be the one chance that Degrassi has. But I have to say, I think Buemi might possibly have got all the points he needs to survive until Montreal, and I think he might become the first guy to go back-to-back in the world of Formula E.
I'd have to agree with you there, Navinas. You know, he's just been very, very impressive. Like, at the start of the season, you know, he was almost unmatchable. Now he's rebounded from the Monaco E-Prix. And he's had, you know, what could only be said as the perfect weekend, you know, with him getting, you know, basically clean out on points, getting the win, and his rival Degrassi, you know, having a terrible weekend. So, yeah, it's just really fantastic for him how it's playing out. You know, and I think we really should be fortunate that he's basically not going to be able to race in the New York E-Prix just to keep the championship open and to take it to Montreal. As you know, if he was racing, then it'll probably be all said and done there, and the Montreal E-Prix would just be all for bragging rights. So yeah, Wemmy doing everything he needs to do once again, and he's just on form, and you know, even if Degrassi does take the lead into Montreal, you know, it's certainly still within Sebastian Buemi's grasp to take the crown at Montreal.
Yes, should certainly be another great weekend. Now we head off the final, effectively final part of this very big weekend of motorsports is the Nürburgring 24 hours. It is probably one of the biggest, most difficult races in the world of endurance racing. I'm trying to find entry list, but I don't think we've got that sorted yet, because I think these things tend to happen at the last minute in terms of driver entry and other stuff. But it will be the ADAC championship. It takes part of a great race last year in terms of an absolutely chaotic one. We had actually had a hailstorm interrupt the race and shut things down, and things have really gone. And we had a fantastic end where we saw passes on the last lap for the lead. A very exciting race, and should just be a great race to watch for free as well. If you want some free motorsport over the weekend, they should be streaming it on YouTube, and there should be a very, very strong set of endurance racing drivers. I can't particularly remember who's in it this year, although I remember last year. I think Chris Harris from Top Gear was in there as well. I think Peter Dumbrack might be as well. But yeah, it should be another great way to end off the weekend, Josh.
Yeah, it certainly will. And racing around the Nordschleife in the dark is certainly in the 24-hour race is certainly no easy feat by any means. As it takes a great amount of skill and great amount of concentration to you know just get through the night, let alone be fast. So yeah, a good mix up of GT3 cars for the 24 hours this year. You know, quite a few Audis. There are a few Lamborghinis as well, and a few Bentleys, which are always a fan favourites, as well as the Porsches. Obviously, the Porsches will always be at the 24 hours of the Nürburgring. So, yeah, it's set to be, you know, a very, you know, long, hard-fought weekend as, you know, basically, you know, anything can happen in the immense dark that is the Nordschleife, as, you know, but even then, you know, there is certainly the opportunity to screw up your race on the Grand Prix circuit.
We found an entry list, by the way, thanks to the people at Daily Sports Car. And we'll have, there's 99 entries going at it. We'll have a quick look through and find some of the big names. Mauro Engel, of course, will be up there as well in the Mercedes. He's a factory driver.
His teammates better watch it if they make a mistake.
Yeah. You don't want to get on the bad side of Mauro Engel. We also have, amongst the others, just looking through, Sabine Smits, the Nürburgring master from the world of Top Gear. Peter Dumbrack, in a BMW as well, should be a very exciting. Rega van der Zander in there as well. Just having a quick look at some of the other names that people might know. Marco Wittmann in there as well. Antonio Felix da Costa moving in from Formula E. We have a lot of the endurance guys coming in. Stefan Mucha, a lot of guys from the WEC as well. A quick look through. I don't seem to really recognize anybody major anywhere else. There probably are, and if you are, we're not endurance racing experts. We'll be the first people to tell you that. But in general, should be a great. There's so many entries. I think it's over 100. It's and that's the thing about it. It's ridiculously long, and there's just so much talents on display, and you really need it. You've got all sorts of people coming from across the world. Surprised that Shane McGisberger has managed to find his way onto a Mercedes drive there. But yes, it'll certainly be another exciting weekend, Josh.
Yeah, it really will be. And you know, even though the basically the Nordschleife and the GP circuit is immensely long, because there are so many entries, there will be complaints and difficulties around around traffic, and certainly that will come up in qualifying and definitely throughout the race as well, as it certainly will be a major hazard at 2 or 3 in the morning at the Nordschleife, especially with it being just so narrow, especially through the carousel. So yeah, that will be definitely something that all team members will have to keep in mind throughout the 24-hour race this weekend. As you know, it's a fantastic race, and certainly one that should be on everyone's bucket list in terms of in terms of what to see in the motoring world. As you know, it certainly will be. It's always great for the fans to just see all the Ferraris, the Bentleys, the McLarens, the Mercedes all roar past at 2:30 in the morning on the Nordschleife. As you know, it's always a spectacle to see, and it's just unfortunate that it's on one of the biggest weekends on the motorsport calendar. And if it was on another weekend, it certainly would get the coverage it deserves.
Yeah, we do have a insane weekend of motorsport, some of the toughest motorsport out there. Of course, it all kicks off on Thursday with practice for Formula One. Then, of course, we have qualifying. Then on Saturday, the Nürburgring 24 hours kicks off, followed by on Sunday, where we have everything come together. The Nürburgring 24 hours finishes up. The Monaco Grand Prix takes place. We also have the Indianapolis 500 soon after. Then to wrap up, the insane 72 hours, I guess, is the Coca-Cola 600, a very big weekend in motorsport indeed. We'll be back next week to wrap everything up, all the news stories. Will Fernando Alonso be able to challenge for the 500? Who will come out on top there? What will happen in terms of Formula 1? Will it be Ferrari, Mercedes, or somebody else prove to be a wild card thrown into the mix? Who will come out on top at the Nürburgring, and as well as who will come out on top of one of the most drooling NASCAR races of the year? Certainly plenty to look forward to. We'll wrap it up all next week. Until then, I've been Naveen Razik.
And I've been Josh Carroll.
And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.